And welcome. It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, and it's a great show today, a great show on tap. It's called Ask Bruce and Peg Anything. Joining us once again, Bruce Helmer, the founder of the Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, as well as Senior Vice President Peg Webb, who's also financial advisor. Welcome to both of you guys. A beautiful day and a lot of great information to be shared. How's everybody doing?
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hello, Peg Webb. Hello, Susie Jones. Good to be with you both, as always. And listeners, thank you for joining us. Susie, we're going to take as many calls from listeners and or text questions of hopefully financially related, but we say ask us anything, so I guess ask us anything. But Peg, there's a couple things going on that I'm hearing from people, from prospective clients, things I'm reading. A couple things maybe to touch base on to get the ball rolling before we get listeners involved. Anything on the forefront of your mind that you want to bring up today, Peg?
Well, what about the markets? I mean, we're almost back to even, and to have that kind of volatility in the month of April, I'm so glad that April is over and it's done with. So, but we get a lot of questions about the stock market and more so these tariffs. And so I want to say again, because I just think it's fabulous that Wealth Enhancement Group is doing this on a weekly basis now. If you go to wealthenhancement.com and you go under insights, there's this word called blog. And every week we have the seven market movers. And one of our representatives from our investment team talks about the week and kind of forecasts. And so it's just a 5-minute read, or you have a choice to watch on a video. And so it was very interesting this past week because they focused on these Magnificent Seven, which Bruce, you and I talk about a lot, because they're the grandest percentage of the S&P 500, a lot of tech stocks. And they all came in with real positive numbers for the first quarter. So it's through April 30th. Now, it's a little unclear, right, about what's going to happen next. But there's still a lot of positive things with employment and earnings growth, you know, possible down the road. And so there's still reasons to be optimistic. But Bruce, I would say the best thing is that we're almost even year to date. We've gained 8% on the S&P 500 in the last 2 weeks, Bruce.
Yeah, we've been up actually, I think, Peg, 9 days in a row. And I think a lot of the uneasiness and queasiness that people were feeling has subsided a little bit. And I don't want to be a downer, and anyone that's listened to this show over the years would agree that I'm generally a positive, optimistic person. But one of the things, Peg, and I want to get your thoughts on this, one of the questions I'm getting from people and one of the things that I see in my own reading and research is that it's great that the markets have kind of bounced back, but the thing about the president's policy, the tariffs, and the uncertainty of the tariffs, I'm hearing a lot of people talk about how businesses, corporately, they don't know how to plan. Is he really going to implement? Is this a negotiating ploy? Is he going to get deals done with other countries? So corporations don't know, if they planned an expansion or they planned to hire more. They've kind of put their plans on hold because they're just uncertain about what's going to happen. And again, I don't want to be negative, but that's something I'm reading about and hearing about, is they're looking for some clarity from the administration. That seems to be the biggest complaint that I'm hearing right now. It's great that we've had 9 good days in a row in the market, but what's actually going to happen and how do businesses plan for it? Are you hearing that or reading that?
Yeah, I am too. But I've always been personally, make the plan, work the plan. I think corporations still have to have some kind of footprint that they're following. And hopefully in the next 60 days or so, we will know more. I mean, we're getting little bits and pieces that create some optimism, but I feel for them because they're so used to just having this work plan and here's what we're all going to do. And especially, you know, with the beginning of the year, that's normally where they're prepared. 2025, this is what we're going to do. Now, there are some positive things, I think, in that, well, I'm not sure that the Fed will cut interest rates, but I think there is some optimism that they may cut interest rates, which would help. Couple of things I didn't know until I got this question recently about the markets and the negative effect of it. I didn't realize that many companies have no or low debt on their balance sheets. So they're actually in a good position, as we just saw with the Magnificent Seven, 6 out of 7 reported. But the ability to pay interest on their debt may be one way for stronger companies to survive through this turbulent time. So I think, Bruce, it's, you know, how big is the company? Are they just going to kind of barge forward? And what's the other companies going to do? But I thought that was a positive for not only us as individuals, where we feel maybe not confident, but strong right now because we've earned so much money on our money the last 5 years. Companies are, you know, trying to figure out how do we continue the motivation of our original plan, or do we make some tweaks, Bruce?
Yeah, and the other one that I'm getting a lot, I don't know if you are, so we've talked about it a lot on the show, that back in 2017, we had a pretty major change to our tax policy. Many people got a reduction in their tax rate. We increased the exemption that we can pass on to future generations. All of that was for 10 years. And it sunsets at the end of this year. And we've been talking about, to our clients, about taxes being on sale, and that unless Congress does something, those tax cuts are going to expire, and rates in 2026 will go back to where they were. With the results of the election, there seemed to be some optimism with the Republican president, Republican majority in the Senate and in the Congress, that we could extend these tax cuts. But now I'm hearing and reading that there's disagreement within the Republican Party on what should be done, and there's a very slim majority. So if a couple of people don't go, you know, with the party, nothing might happen. Because, again, the way the law is set up, Congress has to proactively take action, or these tax cuts automatically go away. They sunset, and it reverts back to old tax law. Are you getting that question? What are you telling people? What are you reading? What are you hearing? I think there's a lot of people interested in that, Peg.
Yeah, we've been working on strategies for years, Bruce, thinking that it is going to change. I mean, we took the idea that we're sunsetting, and an example is, you know, the tax brackets are lower no matter where you are in the tax bracket. They're lower than they used to be. There was some talk this week that maybe we just take that highest tax bracket, and instead of having the highest at 37%, we go back to that 39.6 or something. Then they concluded, well, that's not going to that the people that are fall into that category cannot fund everything we want to fund. And then the other one that we've been working kind of diligently on is the death taxes. So how much tax you have to pay when you die. Well, in 2017, it used to be $11.2 million apiece that we could have tax exempt. And if you have more than that, you know, if you're married, you each get $11.2 million. Now, some of you might be listening saying, who has that? You know, well, it's not that big of a percentage of people. But what happens is if you have $27.2 million right now, but you have more than that, you are going to pay maybe like 30% of that on taxes above that number. Well, it used to be, and it's going to revert back unless they change something, where we had $7 million apiece. 14 million. So if that's dramatic, right? For wealthy people, that if they have 14 million and everything over that is going to be taxed somewhere around 30%. So we work with people on strategies of, you know, what do you want to do with that? So I don't, you know, as far as planning, we as comprehensive planners have, you know, guided clients with these changes, and somehow you have to either just incorporate them in before it happens, which we did throughout all these years, or you just wait and see. Bruce?
Yeah, I think that's a good response. And yeah, who knows? I mean, we never know for sure. We just plan for what we do know, and we make sure that our plan is flexible and adaptable, and whatever happens, we can adjust accordingly. But yeah, I've been being proactive also for years under the assumption that it is going to sunset, and it still might, but I think, again, there's some reason for hope that maybe we can get these extended, because again, I think there's some bipartisan support for this. I don't think this is just a Republican versus Democratic issue. I think there's some people on both sides of the aisle that would like to see the tax cuts extended. The counter argument against it is the independent office, I can't remember what it's called, the budget office, projects or suggests that it's going to increase our federal debt and deficit, which is another, you know, thing that people are always worried about as well. It's going to cost a lot of money to do that. So again, it remains to be seen. It's only the second quarter. We have a lot of time yet this year, but I know people are talking about it, and I know it's on people's minds. And as we learn more, we will be proactive, and we'll address it on the show. Peg, anything else you want to hit before we get listeners involved?
No, let's get listeners involved.
All right, 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. Ask Bruce or Peg anything this next 45 minutes or so, or half an hour. This texter writes, if I give no more than the maximum gifting amount to my nephew and his wife and their child each year, do I need to keep a complete gift tax form for each person because the child is another generation?
So, Peg, I think the texter is talking about the annual gift exclusion, gifting to someone else, and what are the tax ramifications to the gifter, to the recipient of the gift, and not only the tax ramifications, what are the logistics, the policies and procedures, what do people need to do if they're gifting?
Yeah, so in 2025, you can gift $19,000 to anyone and everyone without notifying the IRS. If you decide, and there's one other thing, you can gift 529s, you can front load 529 college saving plans or school saving plans up to $95,000 in 1 year. If you go over that, you simply need to just fill out a form with the IRS and tell them, hey, I gave $20,000 over, or I gave $40,000 over, and you fill out the form. There's no tax to be paid currently. It's just they're going to take it off of your death taxes when you pass away, meaning that if you are higher than the numbers I said a couple of minutes ago about what you can keep tax-free and not get you know, 30% cost on the over amount, then you would have to pay tax. But it's a way for the IRS to keep track of how many gifts you're giving outside of the amount that they give us each year. Bruce?
Peg, I think people are often surprised by how much you can gift without any fuss or muss or tax impact. The $19,000 per year per person, that number in and of itself is probably more than most people can afford to gift anyway. But then when you say $19,000 per year per person, if I'm married and my adult child is married, I can give $19,000 to my child and my child's spouse, and so can my wife. So it really ends up being $76,000 to one family without any tax implications. Now, again, most people listening to us right now can't afford to give $76,000 a year. But when I explain that to people, they're often stunned by how much they could do legally, not that they're going to do it, not that they can afford to do it.
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter did ask a question about the Trump tariffs and the impact on the economy and whether or not both of you think that the tariffs ultimately will either be good or bad for the U.S. economy. Bruce?
Peg?
Oh.
Well,
no, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think people will say, is there fundamentally something happening, you know, albeit it seems drastic and sort of broad strokes, but is the underlying hope that the United States does better in the global economy in terms of getting more for their product, I guess. Isn't that fundamentally what it's about?
It's a great question. Peg, thoughts?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've been doing this for decades, and I have to confess that in my review meetings, I have never used this word very often at all, right?
The tariff.
Right. We don't talk about, oh, this trading between this country. I mean, part of that is because we have a very large investment management team, and they're the ones that track all these things. But I think it's a good question in that people are, last week we had Doug Huber on from our investment team, and it was good that he kind of walked through, you know, and the last question was, what is a tariff? And then he also explained, you know, the pros and cons of what are happening. But I think all in all, with anything that you've been doing for a very long time, right? Where it started, these tariffs started because they wanted to have cheaper labor. You know, the U.S. Couldn't afford the way that we work within the United States, is we couldn't afford to pay people for creating things and building things. So we offshored basically all that employment to, let's say, China. And things have really changed over all these decades, right? Our world economy, the economy of these different countries have changed. And so right now they're just trying to figure out, you know, do we have to pay each other? Because that was a rule that went in decades ago. So that's what they're talking about. Is it a good thing? I think it's a good thing that we're challenging something that's so old. And the way that we're challenging it, I think most people don't like, you know, to have somebody that's that bold and dramatic right up front in the way that it's being negotiated. Mm. And there could have been maybe a different way. But at the end of the day, I think some things will change. And people believe that there's some need for change. And I think we're going to get somewhere. What's negative about all of that is what we've already said in this show. The uncertainty for corporations to plan. I mean, especially employment, right? Do we continue to pay everybody? Do we, you know, let people go? By the way, our job reports are still very high. And so they're still wondering, like, what am I going to do? I think in the next 60 days, we are going to know more than we have today about these tariffs. What I will throw in here, and we didn't get this question yet, we might get this question, is when we were down dramatically in April, especially the beginning of April, we did get questions about people wanting to change how many stocks they had versus how many bonds they had. And Bruce, you and I were on here saying, okay, if you don't have a need for change, then don't do anything. But I think there's some people out there, maybe they don't work with us, Wealth Enhancement Group, that did have a higher percentage of stocks than they probably should have. Well, now is a time if you wanted to rearrange your portfolio, even just a little bit, because you felt like, oh, I don't know if I have enough cash or savings for my retirement. I'm in a lot of these stocks. Then it's time to look at your goals and make sure that now that we're back up, not 100%, but very close, it's a time to revisit your allocation. Bruce?
Yeah, we're almost out of time, yeah. I think, Susie. But really quickly, that was a great answer, Peg. But yeah, if you want to sell stocks right now, even though we're a little bit off the high, if you've been in the market, like Peg said earlier, the last 5 years or more, you still have a lot of embedded gains and you're selling at a profit. And if you want to get more conservative and sell stocks, now would be a great time to do it. Susie?
651-461-9226. We have the entire next half hour for your calls and texts. 651-461-9226. We've got Bruce on the line from St. Paul, and he wants to jump in and ask you a question, but we'll get that on the other side. 651-461-9226. We've got more questions coming in and more answers for you coming up after this short break on News Talk 830 WCCO. It is Your Money, and it is the second half of the program. Bruce Helmer, Senior Vice President and Founder of Wealth Enhancement Group, I guess that tops it all, and Peg Webb is a Senior Vice President and Senior Financial Advisor, and we've got a lot of calls and texts. You guys, do you want to say anything before we jump in, or should we just get going into texts and questions? Bruce?
Let's do it.
All right, Bruce.
Yeah, let's take questions.
All right,
yep.
Bruce, I'm going to say, here's Bruce on the line with a question for you from St. Paul. Bruce, go ahead. You are on the air with Bruce and Peg.
Morning, Susie and Peg and Bruce. I have a question for you. I'm retired. I'm 65 years old. I was going to get a part-time job, and my worker said that I can only make up to $1,050. And then I heard you say something about you get taxed on that. Why would I get taxed? And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Peg, I'm not sure if Bruce is talking about his Social Security benefit in terms of having a part-time job and how much he can earn before having a negative impact on his Social Security benefit. And then with regard to the tax part of his question, obviously, if he's working, that's going to be taxable income. And when you draw Social Security, a lot of people don't know this till they get to the age where they draw, but that's also taxed. So you want to elaborate? I'm not exactly clear on what Bruce asked.
Yeah, I'm not either, but there's a couple things here. One of the things that Bruce asked about is a part-time job, and he's 65 years old. If he's 65, he probably is under the born in like 1960 or something like that. So full retirement age for Social Security would be 67 years old. So he has a couple years to go. And there is a certain amount that you can make without Social Security doing what they call like a clawback, like taking some of the money back. So we coach clients on, if you're going to make more, Bruce said 1,050, if you're under full retirement age, you can make 23,400. Those are your exempt earnings. And so at that point, you wouldn't owe anything. So it is a little bit of a tricky situation, I think, because you do have to follow those rules. And then once you are 67 and if you start drawing your full retirement money, then you don't have to worry about that number anymore. So so it is a little complicated. The second one is about taxing Social Security. And I think in this case, Bruce is not planning on claiming his Social Security, maybe and not until he's 67. But if you're married filing jointly and you're under 32,000, then you're not subject to tax on your Social Security. Ask me how many people get to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Not many, because everything you have dividend income, You might have municipal bond income, which is kind of a tricky one because people say, oh, municipal bonds are tax-free. Why do I have to include that in my tax calculation for whether my Social Security is included? There's all sorts of things that they include. So it doesn't allow many people to not pay something on their Social Security. They also do have an amount that's subject to tax up to 50%, which is a different dollar amount, up to $44,000. They're not giving us a lot big bump after the 32, but then most people end up paying 85% of their Social Security, no matter what the dollar amount is, over $44,000. So that category is truly filled. So Bruce, I kind of highlighted a couple things there, but we can't be real definitive. And I know that Bruce hung up, but I tried to clarify a couple things.
651.
Oh, I think that.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Susie. But I think that was excellent. The only thing, Peg, I was going to add is, again, Bruce, if I understood his question correctly, and Bruce, we hope you're listening, and we hope we answered it. There seems to be, again, some confusion about the taxability of Social Security. And Peg explained it very well, that when they determine whether or not you pay taxes on your Social Security benefit, they add almost any income you can think of, including if you have tax-free municipal bonds or municipal bond funds, that's included, plus 50% of your Social Security benefit is added back in. The only thing that doesn't count is Roth IRA income. So it is very, very, very difficult, nearly impossible to stay below the $32,000. In fact, as Peg said, the $44,000, which means you're going to pay 85%, not an 85% tax rate, but on 85% of the benefit. So if your monthly benefit is $2,000 a month, you're going to pay taxes on $1,700 of it, whatever your tax bracket is. So, but the other big thing, Peg, the first one that you hit on, is that, yes, if you're not yet at full retirement age and you're going to work a part-time job, if you think you're going to make more than $23,400, I would tell you not to start that benefit that year. Or if your part-time job, you know you're not going to make that much and you want to turn on Social Security at 65, then I wouldn't tell you not to do it. But we do that analysis for all of our clients. That standard operating procedure, all of our clients, we will help them make the determination when and how to draw Social Security to try to make sure they get it right, because it's not as easy as everybody thinks it is. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, what are the pros and cons of paying off a mortgage loan? If it has 3% at 3 years left, just retired, wife will in the next year. Thanks. That's from Kevin. Thanks for that question, Kevin. Go ahead, you guys.
Thank you, Kevin. Peg, I know how you feel about this one. You can go first.
Well, I do like to be debt-free. I've been that way a major part of my life. But 3% is a really good low interest rate. The one thing I would say is if you only have 3 years left. You know how mortgages work. If it's a 30-year mortgage, in the beginning, you're paying a substantial amount of interest and not paying off a lot of principal. When you get this low to you only have 3 years left, it's mostly principal that you're that you're having to pay in the last 3 years. So with clients that just say, you know, I would love to be deemed as a debt-free person, I would say if you've got the money just sitting in a money market or something, go and do that. The negative of that would be you're still earning quite well on money markets or short-term investments. So you may not want to do it. I think it's more, Bruce, just, hey, I'd love to tell myself that I'm debt-free and have my little debt-free party, right? So, Bruce?
Yeah, and again, I'll use myself as the example. I still have a mortgage. It's at 3 1/8 or 3.125%. At the risk of seeming ostentatious, I could write a check and pay off my mortgage tomorrow. I choose not to because the investments that I have that I would take the money from to pay off the mortgage have consistently outpaced the cost of the debt service. So now, two things. If I didn't think I could earn a return higher than the cost of the debt service, like what if the loan was at 9% or 8% or 10%, then I'd give a very different answer, and I'd say you want to pay down debt. And or if I were planning to retire, even though the economics don't change and I still think I could keep that money working for me, earning a return higher than the cost of the debt service, I think there's something, Peg, about being retired and wanting to have that mortgage burning party and saying I'm debt-free and I don't owe anybody anything. So I'd probably change my tune if I ever, you know, felt like I was going to retire. But at this point, I'm nowhere close to retirement, and I have no interest in paying off my mortgage right now. Even though I could, I choose not to. But if somebody emotionally comes in and says, yes, Bruce, I understand the economic argument, but I want to do it anyway, I'm not going to try to talk you out of it. Part of being a financial advisor is not just looking at, we're not robots. We don't just look at, you know, cash flow analysis and returns and numbers. Part of it is understanding your priorities, how you think and how you feel, what your risk tolerance is. You got to be able to relax. You got to be able to sleep at night. So if somebody wants to pay it off, I'm not going to tell them not to. But economically, I don't think with the interest rate that low, I don't think it's the best thing to do. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. Chuck has been waiting on the phone. He is calling today from Hastings. Chuck, thanks for coming on with us. I hope you're doing well. And here's Bruce and Peg. Ask your question, please.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. My question relates to the amount of Social Security my wife and I get. I made good money while I was working. We're both retired. She did not. She worked very little, which was kind of a blessing with the family. But now that we have our Social Security combined, if I pass on, is she going to be able to continue to collect anything from my side, or is my side going to be gone and she has to rely only on her end of the Social Security, if you know what I mean?
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you for listening, and thank you for the question. And Peg, again, this gets into Chuck's question is another example of how complicated this can get. So everybody looks at their own benefit, and they can, you know, contact Social Security, go to the website, set up their account, and they can project what their payment's going to be based on what age they start to draw. But then you add all these little complexities. In a married relationship, your spouse might also have a work history. What can they get? How does that work if somebody dies, to Chuck's question? So in this situation, how would that work for Chuck if he predeceases his wife and she didn't work outside home a lot and would not have a big benefit on her own record?
Yeah, so you are correct, Bruce, that the Social Security is more complex than I believe it's always been, but I think it's with the combination of the person who's working and the person who was working inside the home all these years, their Social Security is a lot different, meaning the value of what you get. So if something happens to Chuck, then the wife or the significant other will step up to the amount that you have. It's the higher of the two. While you're still alive, she should get a higher percentage of what you made. So what I would do is recommend that you work with your financial planner, because a lot of people don't know that their financial advisor is very good at, like at Wealth Enhancement Group, we have a software that we run with all these different scenarios. And it's good to get educated on all those different scenarios. And I would say even beyond talking to Social Security, although they're great, but your advisor would know better what strategy you should use and how would you maximize that benefit, you know, long-term, Bruce?
Yeah, and I that was good, Peg. The only thing I would add, just a little clarity, I think while they're both alive, Chuck's spouse can take either her own benefit or 50% of his benefit, whichever is higher. And the way Chuck articulated the question, I think 50% of his benefit would be higher. So she would probably take that. But, yeah, and again, in terms of when you start to draw, and this wasn't part of Chuck's question, I always tell people, to your point, Peg, that we can do that analysis. We can do future value forecasting, cash flow analysis, and we can say if you take it at this age versus this age, here's how long you have to live to get more net benefit. We could, it's just simple math. But the decision when the exercise isn't that simple, there's a lot of other variables that come into play. What's your health like? Do you want to leave a legacy to your children and grandchildren, or is that not a high priority? What was your parents' health like? Do you seem to have the longevity gene in your life? Because there's a lot of things that we do know about the client, and we use that information, we do the analysis, but there's some things that we don't know. And, of course, the biggest one we don't know, and this is part of Chuck's question, is when are we going to die? So we have to make assumptions based on actuarial science to do these predictions, but it's never going to be an exact science. But by doing that research and analysis, we enhance the chances that you maximize that benefit. Again, not everybody wants to maximize, and I've talked about this. In fact, we did a show on this recently where I talked about the fact that sometimes I've been able to demonstrate, Peg and Susie and listeners, to my client that if you wait longer to draw your benefit, you're probably going to get more net income over your lifetime if you live, you know, to your statistical life expectancy. But the client will still choose to turn it on sooner because they want to front load retirement income. They want it, they're going to take some from investments, but they're also going to take Social Security, and they're going to go do more in their early in their retirement. They're going to travel and check things off their bucket list. So even though they might get net less over their lifetime, they don't care because they want more income early in retirement. And that does make some sense, and that's part of the thought process that we use when we try to project what's the best way to draw your Social Security. But it's, again, I can't say this often enough, it can be way more complicated than people think it is, Susie.
All right, 651-461-9226. You can call that number or you can text your question to Bruce and Peg, 651-461-9226. We have about 5 minutes left of the program. A texter writes, what is the best account to open for a grandchild that isn't necessarily just for education?
Peg?
Well, you can actually do a Gift to Minors Act account. Hmm. And if you do that, there's pros and cons to all these different options. But if you do that, you know, I had a lot of clients ask me over the years, you know, can you buy a few shares of Apple stock or Microsoft or, you know, something like that and put it in this young person, this grandchild's account? Well, number one, a grandchild cannot have an account, you know, unless you're 21 years old. And so you have to have a custodian or a trustee or somebody like that. Then you can, you know, buy individual stocks or mutual funds or ETFs, whatever you want to do. There is, I forget what it's called now. It's an account that you can open with just $2,000 for a minor. And then that account actually would automatically go to that grandchild at 18 years old. But in that particular one, you can buy what you want to buy as well. So the other one that we do a lot with is the college ones. And even if you did deposit money to a 529 or an educational account and you don't use it, you know, for education, you can always name a different person if you still had an earmark kind of in your head for that grandchild, but you could change the name to a different person that might need more money to for their college education. Or if you cash out that 529, you're going to have a penalty. Bruce?
Yeah, really quickly, that's great. Awesome, Peg. I would only add that time horizon is going to be a big issue here in terms of all those options that Peg talked about. So in other words, if it's a newborn baby that's not going to use this money for 18, 20 years, whether it's education or whatever, that's going to be a different choice than if it's a 16-year-old kid that might be using the money in the next 3 or 4 years. So Peg gave a lot of options in terms of what's the right one. I think one of the big things is how old is this grandkid and what's the time horizon until when they're going to use the money. Susie, I can squeeze in one more.
All right, let's do it. This texter writes, if you take money for a gift out of an IRA account, do you pay taxes on that as income?
So, Peg, somebody wants to gift. We talked earlier about gifting. Yep. You can gift up to $19,000 per year per person. They want to make the gift with an IRA.
No. No, you can't. So if you take that money out of your IRA and you would like to gift it to someone, that actually has to go on your income tax for the year that you pulled the money out. And then you would be able to give the net dollars as a gift. So no, there's no way getting around that.
Okay. But I wonder if people do that, if they can do it, right, as a way to gift something to a child. You just have to pay taxes on it. It's not the worst
thing.
That's
right. You're going to get a 1099. And by the way, if you're 59 and a half or older, then you won't have a penalty. But if this person is under 59 and a half and pulled out the money, you would have an additional penalty on taking that money out prior to 59 and a half.
We have about a
minute.
Oh, you go ahead.
Quickly, Susie. And again, you're right. A lot of people probably do end up doing that because they don't have any alternative. At Wealth Enhancement, we talk a lot about having tax diversification, and many people listening right now don't have that. They have the majority of their savings and investments and their net worth in these tax-deferred accounts, like a company retirement plan, like a 401k or an IRA. So now if they want to do something with that money, whether it's make a gift or spend it or whatever, they're going to have to pay the taxes because they don't have any diversification. They don't have any options. They don't have any choice. That's one of the things we work with people on to try to create that diversification to give them options. And I know now that we're about out of time.
Great questions today, though. Thanks, everyone, for being part of the show. It is Your Money, Bruce Helmer, Peg Webb. And if you didn't get your question answered, you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE, or you can email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. That is yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great week.